Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome to another special bonus episode of the Paul Ryder Tapes. This week, it's Paul's great friend, builder, star of ITV's 60 Minute Makeover, an all-round great guy, Jason Godwin.
I'm a good friend of Paul's, I'd like to think so, since 1998, and yourself and the rest of your family. So, yeah, it's a real privilege and a kind of honour, actually, because you, when Paul sadly passed away last July, you'd asked me to speak at his funeral, and I kicked myself now, but I was so terrified about speaking about Paul and breaking down and in front of the royalty of Manchester's music scene that I bottled it, really. And so to get to speak about Paul now, a few months on with you, is a real, real privilege and an honour.
You just have to be on, like, just be real. It's not about, you know.
Well, I don't think I could be anything else because that was the foundation of me and Paul's relationship. It was one that was just very, I got to know Paul's demons before I got to know Paul's angels, you know?
So take me back to the very, very beginning.
Okay. Well, mutual friend of ours, Tom.
Yeah.
He'd been to an NA meeting up in Manchester and he said to me, and he was a good friend of mine. He said to me, he said, never believe who I met the other day. He said, in this meeting in Manchester, the lad from the Happy Mondays, Paul Ryder. And I was like, oh yeah. He goes, yeah. And he's going to come down and stay with me. And I said, oh, wow, that's fucking amazing. Because the Mondays for us, being part of that, like, I'm going to take you back to 1988, and we was all into acid house music and mad parties and everything, where I went to school and they were very much into rock bands. So, like, being into house music and acid parties and going to raves wasn't a cool thing. But the Mondays come along, and they were a guitar band, and they made playing the guitar cool again. It was all right to listen. They had that groove and they had that funk. So I was like, wow, Paul out of the Mondays, you know. And so Paul came down to stay with Tom, I think. This was around about 1998, I want to say. Yeah, around about 1998. And he come to a meeting in Hartford where I used to go as well. And I always remember it because Tom and Paul were sitting on the other side of the room. For the whole of this meeting, Paul was staring at me. And I was thinking, what's wrong with me? What is it? And after the meeting, we went and had a coffee, me, Tom and Paul. And he said to me, he said, oh, I like your trainers. Because I was clocking them in the meeting, your trainers. I was like, it's a funny thing. I was like into your trainers as well. And he took my number and like, at the time, I wasn't, probably like most people in those meetings, Paul as well, I was really, really struggling in my life. I was looking for some answers and I was looking for some help. And the fact that the guy from the Happy Mondays had wanted to take my phone number just blew me away. And he called me the next day. And I'll never forget it, Ange, because I saw his name come up on the phone and I was like, no way, he's calling me. What does he want? And I answered. And we're chatting away and he's like, oh, it was good to see you last night and that. And he said, do you want to swap them trainers you got on for my trainers?
Really? I didn't know.
And that's how it started. And we went on for years after that, just swapping clothes, because we were round about the same sort of height and size and same foot size as well. So, yeah, we that's kind of the first memories I have of meeting Paul were a meeting. And to be honest, the spotlight on the Mondays had long since gone out, and Paul was, he was not in a good place. I was not in a good place. So really, we didn't have that distraction of him being a rock star, because he was just Paul when he was in recovery.
Had me and him already got together?
You and him were together, because the next thing I kind of remember is coming down to St. Anne's Road in Islington.
St. Paul's Road.
St. Paul's Road, sorry.
Yeah.
In Islington, where I remember knocking on the door, Tom knocking on the door, because we was going to go out with Paul to a meeting.
Yeah.
And Paul opened the door and you just walked out of the toilet. I'd never met you before. And you just literally found out that you was pregnant with Sunny.
Yeah.
So we turned up at the most inappropriate of moments, because it was clearly a special moment for you two. We ended up going to a meeting and stuff, but that's the first time I remember meeting you both. Meeting you anyway, Ange.
I remember you and Tom being there in the house when I just found out I was pregnant, and you had long hair at the time, didn't you?
Yeah, really clearly.
Yeah.
And then somewhere around about that time, I remember him, we were supposed to go to a meeting. And he said, oh, I'm going to call round and see my mate, see Rob. Yeah. And I just thought it was his mate, Rob. So we went up to Notting Hill, me and Tom and Paul. And he knocks on the door and it was Robbie Williams he was going to see, right? And I found myself in Robbie Williams' house with Paul and Tom. And before I knew it, he was inviting us to Wembley to see him play at Wembley with Paul. And Paul was going, no, I think I'm going to do a meeting. I was like, no, let's go to Wembley and watch Robbie Williams. Don't even like take that all. But I thought this is a chance.
Did you go?
Yeah. We went. And I had this surreal moment of being in the toilet at Robbie Williams's house and phoning Dawn, my then partner. And I was surrounded by all these kind of music awards and everything, just thinking, how has this happened that I'm with not only one of my, just I really did revere the Mondays as a band back in their early days. So to be with Paul and then suddenly with this guy who's just left Take That and he was going out on his own and he was showing us videos of his new single and stuff, it was just a mad time. And it was just crazy.
Brilliant.
Well, at least expected.
Yeah. So what do you think it was that bound you to Paul? Like, what do you think was responsible for your friendship being as strong as it was?
I think it was what I identified in Paul was that kind of social awkwardness, that kind of vulnerability, just feeling very fragile and very delicate. And an imposter syndrome, almost low self-esteem, all that kind of stuff. We shared it. As I got to know him and that, I realized he was just as fragile as I was. And I think that's what drew us together. We were delicate souls.
Mm. And at the time you were working as a builder, but you're also converting your own house, weren't you? Tell me about that.
That's right. Yeah. So we was converting an old chapel into a new house. And I think I met you a few times and you'd said to me, I want to come down and do a showreel because I think you should be on TV. And what you may or may not realize is you're responsible for my career now, really, of what I do now.
How? I don't understand.
That showreel that you shot that at the house, that didn't do anything for 2 years. And then all of a sudden, one day, I got a phone call from ITV saying, oh, we've seen this showreel. And I don't know how this happened, Ange. Yeah. You must, because you did the showreel. But she said, we've seen a showreel of you and we'd like you to come and audition for a TV program called Jade Salon, which, do you remember Jade Goody, TV girl that was on, I think, was it Big Brother she was on? Yeah. And they wanted me to be the builder that converted the salon. Mm-hmm. And I went down to do a screen test on the back of that showreel that you did at the chapel. Mm-hmm. And they said, I remember doing the screen test and then a few weeks later they said, oh, we'd already chosen the guy that we wanted to do this and it wasn't you, but you came down and made an impact and we want to go with you. And from that, I went on to work in TV for 6 or 7 years, a 60-minute makeover, all of which Paul appeared on as well. That was crazy. I always remember he was in the back of the van, covered up with a load of tools and everything, and they played the Happy Mondays and he came out with his tool belt on and was trying to help us do up this place on daytime TV. It was surreal.
You got him the gig on 60 Minute Makeover then to do
it? I'm the gig on 60 Minute Makeover, and at the time he wasn't doing anything. He was just struggling to stay clean and sober, really.
Yeah.
There was no work for Paul or anything. And then I think that's about the time that I started coming up to Worsley and meeting you guys and the open door policy of your house where you just let all the waifs and strays in, it seems.
Yeah.
And so I'd be traveling up to Manchester. And I always remember getting to yours and Paul would always be in bed, shut himself away. And then he'd come down late at night and me and him would sit up to the early hours of the morning watching the most bizarre cop shows and detective series and anything murder mystery. That's what I wanted. And that's when we really started to bond. It was the late night discussions. And when you're trying to get clean and sober, there's a depth and an honesty to the conversation that doesn't exist in day-to-day conversations with people. Yeah. So I couldn't believe he was the guy from the Mondays, the bass player and original member of the Mondays, and yet he felt as insecure and disillusioned with everything as I was. And that was crazy. And I didn't really look at him because they'd long since split up the Mondays and we never did anything sort of show busy or anything. It was meetings, coffee shops, either at your house or periodically he'd come down to Hertfordshire.
Yeah. So there was a time when a dark, very dark time in his life when I think, I can't remember exactly what had happened that made me kick him out, but I think he'd been to rehab and then come back and use the next day. I think he'd been to Antigua and had come and like used straight away. And that was it for me. And I packed him off down to you.
I seem to remember you funding a lot of very expensive rehab programs around the world.
Yeah.
None of them being of any success for him.
Yeah.
And yeah, he ended up coming to stay and live at my mum's house, which that was just insane because he wasn't clean and sober.
Tell me about, I mean, I know what was going on because he'd call me, oh, I need, send me £15, send me 50, like he'd want money every time, and like, oh. It was one of those awful things that, like, I went to the meetings for my lot, the Al-Anon lot, and you know, told not to enable, but I just felt like if I washed my hands of him, he'd die. Like it was that bad. And if I really kicked him out and nobody was there to scoop him up, he would die. That was the fear. And I think that's what the fear is of anyone who's got a loved one who's using. Like, yeah, tough love. You're meant to do the tough love. They reach their rock bottom, but they can also die. And I think my fear was that if I did that, he'd die. So I kind of copped out by sending him to you because I knew you'd scoop him up.
Well, we tried to, and I was still struggling myself, truth be told, Anne. Yeah, well, we'll get on to that. Oh. But yeah, he came to stay with Mum, and I remember going around to Mum's house quite a few times, and he'd got Mum pissed, and they were both pissed together, and I was thinking, oh, if Ange finds out, this is not going to be good. It was, I don't think, looking back, I don't think it was, well, it was probably a good move for you because you needed that little bit of space and everything. But in terms of, I don't think Paul was ready in his recovery at that time. That's when I started to convert the chapel, and Paul would come up and stay with me and Dawn up at the chapel. So right. He didn't have any money, and he was constantly badgering me for money and everything. And I said, the only way I'm going to give you money is if you earn it. So you're going to have to come and work for me. And I'd have him lay in this pack. I remember it because it was freezing cold, pissing down with rain. And he was laying a patio and knocking up the sand and cement for me.
And how was he as a worker? No,
Paul wasn't the most kind of athletic of people. So to see him work, he really struggled to kind of do it. But he did it. And the one thing I remember is we bought this Arga. Reconditioned Arga, and me and Dawn had gone out one night, and we came back, and he was cooking burgers on top of the Arga, but not on a pan, just the burgers on top of the Arga. And I had these two burger marks on my Arga till the day we sold that place. So whenever I used to open this Arga, I used to see these two burger marks, and I was thinking, Paul, because he just put them straight on top of the Arga, thinking you could just cook on the hot plate.
Then the dark times. So did you feel the brunt of dealing with a using addict and not knowing what to do? Like how much did that affect you? Is it because you were struggling yourself, you said? Like that must have been quite difficult for you.
I think always in the back of my mind, I had you and the boys kind of thinking that Paul was down staying with us, trying to get himself sorted, and I knew that he was really struggling and would just disappear and use. I remember there was a big jar of those big whiskey bottles with all the pennies in and everything. He'd fucking nicked that out of my garage and gone and changed up all the money to score with.
Oh.
And I felt a bit hurt at the time, but I understood, obviously. And there was other incidents.
Did he admit to doing that?
Yeah.
Did you confront him and say, have you taken my money?
Do you know what? I don't know. I probably didn't confront him actually over that one. I was just like, oh, whatever. I let it go because I kind of knew Paul wasn't himself right then. It wasn't the real Paul. He was in the grips of his addiction. I'd had enough glimpses or insights to see the real Paul to know that that wasn't him. And that was the addiction kind of at work. So I guess there was forgiveness and tolerance there like there was with you, because roll the clock on quite a few years later and you get the clean version of Paul.
The thing that kept me going with him was that I genuinely believed, and I think I was right, I genuinely believed that he had a desire to be clean. Like I never felt like he'd given up. And as long as he had the desire and kept trying, that's what kept me there, for rightly or wrongly. But I always felt that he was using against his own wishes to do that because he was in the grips of a disease.
I think most addicts who arrive at the doors of recovery are in that same dilemma, aren't they? The desire to use is there. They just can't stop using for whatever reason. So, yeah, I believe that too. So I think I was probably forgiving of him for some of the things that happened.
Let's talk about when I came down for the weekend with the boys and we stayed in, was it the Marriott in Hartford?
Yeah, I think so, wasn't it?
And that was terrible. That was such a harry. So I remember waking up. So we were in a room with the two boys and we all went to sleep. And I woke up in the night and Paul wasn't there. And so I went looking for him. And it must have only been maybe midnight or something. And I found him in the hotel bar holding court with all these people talking about being the bass player of the Mondays, absolutely legless, drunk. And he was like, sit down, sit down. So I sat down with them. I'd left the kids in the room. And then 5 minutes later, the hotel manager came looking for me because the kids had woken up and they were beside themselves crying because nobody was in the room. And I felt like such a bad mother that I'd abandoned my kids. It was like a real metaphor. I'd abandoned my kids in this hotel room to go and find Paul and had sat down in the bar with him. And I felt so bad. That's one of my worst parenting moments, that where I let me caretaking him overtake my responsibilities as a mum and left the kids in the room crying. Well, they weren't crying when I left, but they'd obviously woken up when I'd gone. And then the next day, Paul, and then I still to this day don't know whether it was just for dramatic purposes, but do you remember I called you because he basically said he was going to go in the bathroom and hang himself and grabbed a belt and went in the bathroom and locked the door, and I was beside myself, so I had to get you and Tom to come down.
I think we showed up and he hadn't obviously hung himself, but he was certainly in a dark, dark place.
Yeah.
There was lots of times like that, wasn't there? I remember coming up to Worsley quite a few times and knocking on your door and you was just beside yourself because he'd taken his bass guitars down to the pawn shop to do what he needs to do to get what he needs to get. Yeah. Me and Tom was always amazed about how resilient or codependent, maybe.
Codependent, yeah.
Yeah, you was around that time and Paul. But I got it myself because I felt the same way. It was like he really, really struggled to get clean and sober. And I was on the receiving end of some not good stuff back in those days. And but I always had it in my heart to forgive him because I knew that wasn't real Paul.
All right, let's go to some better time. So you came up to Manchester, and can you remember any memories of being in the house in Manchester, doing up the house?
Well, really, really fond memories of being in Manchester, not least of all Paul's dad. I remember one of the first times I come up to Manchester, and you know that little green that was out the front of yours? I remember pulling in there, and I just see this fella sat on a deck chair with a few tins of beer, and it was Paul's dad. That was the first time I met his dad. But yeah, no, I'm sure there must have been some difficult times, but looking back now, as a whole, I found that time, your house was always so welcoming. It was lovely getting to know you, and you and I become friends then, because a lot of the time Paul was just not around. So it'd be me and you speaking to the early hours of the morning. Mm. And then talking about this illness that we all know so well. And it must be difficult for you not being an addict or an alcoholic, understanding that. And I have fond memories of that time when he came back up to Manchester and then working for you. And then, of course, you moved to France, or you bought the house.
I bought the place in France.
I did think you was both mad at the time.
Tell me why. Why did you think we were mad?
I mean, it was a beautiful looking house, but I turned up there and just thought, oh my God, this place is huge. You know, this is going to be worth a few quid. But when we went inside, it didn't look like it had any work done to it since about 1982, when the previous owner...
Oh, the 70s.
Or the 70s, yeah. So it was... And I saw that it was total rewiring, replumbing. And I was thinking, I cannot let them buy this place. Yeah. And I was doing everything in my power to put you off of it.
What was wrong with it?
Oh, well, like I say, the wiring hadn't been touched since the 70s. The plumbing hadn't been touched since the 70s. The decor hadn't been touched since probably the 60s. And it was a huge sprawling pad, wasn't it? The one thing I remember was the river and the stuff running with, there's a story there with the river.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I just thought you was taking on way, way more. And you was expecting me to kind of help you renovate this place. And I was thinking, I don't speak French. If I come over, how are we going to do all this? And yeah, it just seemed like way too much.
So obviously then we went ahead and bought it.
So you went ahead and bought it. and convinced me to come out there and help you do it up. So that's when I kind of decamped and moved to France. Best part of a year, I think it was, Ange, because at the time, Dawn was pregnant with Millie, Amelie, my daughter. Yeah. And we came out there, and I think we started on the Jeep first, didn't we?
Yeah.
We converted that, and then we started doing some work in the main house.
Do you remember, were you there when he rode the tractor naked?
Well, somewhere on a laptop is pictures of Paul in his wellies, stark bollock naked, riding the lawnmower. Yeah, I took the pictures and I've got them all. And I often thought I could get a few quid for these pictures, but I've never done anything with them. But I'm going to let you have them for sure.
We need to see these pictures. Yeah.
And then I do remember we was getting well behind with the work and everything because, unbeknown to you, I think you thought that I was still clean and sober, where I was struggling myself. And whenever you'd go away, Paul would have me up at that little local pub where all the farmers went, and we'd be drinking ouzo and God knows what else. And I always remember the barmaid saying, "He's a rock star. Who is he?" And I said, "Well, you know, you too." I said, "He back in England, his band are bigger than you too." Yeah. So we used to just get free drinks all the time. Everyone was buying us drinks and everything.
But we did get the place finished in the nick of time for the guests. Because what happened was we'd rented the cottage out and we'd rented the half of the house that didn't need quite so much work doing. We'd taken bookings for the summer. And then the idea was that we'd stay in the other half that wasn't renovated.
But you know what I remember? Some of my fondest memories of being in France was that's where me and Paul really got close. We would be out on the patio at night. He'd be listening to the radio. And that's where our love of music, soul and funk music, and just that's where we really kind of got really, really close.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I always used to say to Paul, one day I'm going to watch you at Wembley, yeah? And you'll be back with your brother and you'd have sorted stuff out. And strangely enough, the last time I saw Paul was at Wembley, when he played Wembley, Christmas 2021, whatever it was.
Right, you know. Yeah. But he hadn't really reconciled with Sean. There wasn't a...
I don't think they had, but we called it the VAT tour. He was there to pay the bills and all the rest of it. But for me, as a fan of the Mondays, and just the fact that they were back together and he was in his band and he was up there doing what he'd always loved doing, that for me was just such a wonderful thing to see after all the years of isolation.
Let's just wind back. So there was the period where the fake Mondays were doing all these gigs and Paul wasn't involved. But then in 2012, we'd already moved to LA. And then in 2012, it was announced that the original lineup, so the original band, were reforming and they were going to do a tour. Do you remember finding out about that and how you
felt? Yeah. I remember having a conversation with Paul and said, like, the Mondays are back together. I remember Paul doing his usual thing with me where he'd be like, "Yeah, I've got your tickets." And I'd be phoning him like 2 days before, "Where am I going to meet you?" And he just blanked me completely because we know what he's like around a phone. And then literally like half an hour before the show had started, he'd say, "Come round to the side gate, I'll let you in." So yeah, they got back together. And then I think for the next 4 or 5 years, every time they came over, that would be the only time I'd meet up with Paul. But we'd speak periodically on the phone.
But very significantly, you were with Paul on a certain day in December 2012 when he got a phone call from me telling him that the doctor had said that Chico had cancer. Do you remember that? Tell me about that day.
Oh, I remember they were playing at the Roundhouse in Camden, which is one of my favourite venues. And I was really, really looking forward to the gig and meeting up with Paul. And we'd said that we was going to grab some food before the gig. Usual thing, come up to the hotel, meet me, and we'll go out and get some food. And then you can come and see sound check. I remember being in the room of this hotel with him. And he told me that Chico hadn't been very well. And he was expecting a call from you. And I remember being in the hotel room with him and you call in and him getting the news that Chico had cancer. And I think at the time, Millie, my daughter, would have been about 1 or 2 years old. And I was just, I couldn't get my head round. He came off the phone, he was in shock. And I was like, you're supposed to be on stage in like 2 hours time and you've just received this news. Do you not want to just go home? And he was like, I don't know what to do. And it was the most awful gig I'd ever been to because he obviously played that night. And I remember being at the front watching him thinking, what is going through his mind right now?
How did he take the news? What did he do?
He was not good. He was crying. We cuddled. We had a hug. I remember that. He was devastated, like you would.
And then the next year, did you see much of him during the next year when Chico was in treatment? Because I know he was going back to England.
He stayed in touch quite a lot. And obviously he was keeping me updated on his treatment and everything. I can't remember if he played any more time, if he came over to play in that time. It was heartbreaking. Honestly, hand on my heart, you're two of the loveliest people I've ever met in my life. And to know that you was going through that with your child was just, I couldn't get my head around it. I couldn't understand how you functioned and how you kind of just blows my mind still to this day.
Yeah, you just do it because there's no choice.
You don't know what you can do until you have to do it.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
Because I just wanted to get him on a plane back to you. I was like, Paul, just go now. Just get on a plane. I'll run you to the airport.
I think he was coming back like 2 days later or something. I think he already got a flight booked, I think, on Christmas Eve. And he was coming back with Pat, who was our childminder's husband. Our childminder, Betty, had passed away the previous year. And her husband had spent Christmas by her graveside the previous Christmas. So I said to him, come and have a family Christmas with us. Come to LA. And he was flying back with Paul on Christmas Eve and he flew back in to Chico having cancer and like it not being that family Christmas that we were hoping for. Yeah. But actually, he was kind of a godsend because he kind of kept the mood a bit light and bright. You know, he was kind of quite a good presence at that point, but yeah, that was heavy duty. It was
funny, those moments, like I say, the moment you found out that you was pregnant with Sunny and the moment you found out Chico and Son.
Keep away from you, wasn't I? Oh dear. So how did you feel when you found out that the Mondays were reforming? Were you worried for Paul? Did you think he would be able to handle it? Were you worried he'd relapse? Like, where was your head about that?
No, because at the time I remember him having a strong recovery and he was taking it seriously. He was doing his meetings in LA and he seemed to have had a grasp on things. And then I met him at the Brixton Academy gig, which I think was the first time that I saw them when they got back together. And I was actually not sure whether he was still using or not at the time, because I thought he was still a bit, because Paul had this terrible anxiety around playing live and playing gigs. Mm-hmm. I always used to say, look, I'll meet up with you after, not before, because before you won't even talk to me because you're going to be sick and used to get really anxious before playing. So I remember meeting him before the gig and thinking, I'm not sure whether he's using, but looking back now, I think he was probably just anxious and really wound up because...
He was probably using. I would put money on that. If you thought he was using, he would have been using.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas certainly in the last few years when I saw Paul, I knew he was clean. I just felt it in my heart. But I think back then, maybe he was still struggling. I don't know. He didn't admit to me, which he usually would do.
Oh, okay. So. All right. Maybe he wasn't then.
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. And maybe it was just some old fears that I had. But I know that he used to get really nervous before a gig. So I think I just...
One thing that he did used to do, he used to abuse his prescription meds. So yes. Maybe he just had one or two too many of his...
Too many
medications, yeah. Actually. That could have been it.
And I think there was another time at rolling on maybe four or five years ago, again at the Roundhouse. And I think it was the first or the second time that I took my daughter Amelie along to see him. We went backstage before the gig and Paul was so ill. And he said he had a cold and usual stuff. And I was like, no, he's using again. And I was like, And that whole show, I was looking at him thinking, yeah, you don't look very well. And I was worried. But he swore blind, he was clean at the time. And he'd never, I knew Paul through those dark times. So he knew he could be honest with me about whether he was using or not. So I don't know. Roll the clock on. You know where I used to live in Ware, seeing this poster with like the Happy Mondays are playing at this festival in where I live, which is, it's just a small little town. I was like, so I texted him and said, no way, you're playing where I am. And he was like, yeah, you're going to come down with Millie. And I said, yeah. And we went down and it was the best I'd ever seen him. And that and the last time I saw Paul. And I knew he was clean then. I genuinely knew he was clean. Not long after the fire. So we went to watch that gig, some little festival thing. And he was really good. And we'd made plans to the next year. So this would be 2020. I was going to come out and go and see him, go and stay with him. He had the Wembley gig coming up. So we went to the Wembley gig. This was the last time that I saw Paul. And what was beautiful about that is that he remembered that it was Amelie's birthday, my daughter's birthday. And he got her a card and he put 50 quid in there. And when we met up with him, he gave it a card. And I thought, that fuckers don't even know when my birthday is. But he remembered it. So I had a little bit of a resentment with him there. But he was just, and I didn't know that was the last time I was going to see him because we'd actually got, we was planning to meet him the weekend before he passed away at Alexandra Palace. We was going down to see him there. And that's when I was texting him. Because it all came through via social media that Paul had died. That's the way I found out. It was the most heartbreaking. It was awful. And then I think me and you spoke that evening. And when I finally spoke to you, that's when I kind of accepted that he'd passed away. And And even now, I am... There's a part of me that thinks that he's still around. The impact he had on my life, along with yourself, Ange, is something that it changed everything. It was a game changer. Just you two were so down to earth and so not rock and roll and so not showbiz, but just decent, honest, just lovely, lovely people to spend time with. I look back now and I know there was lots of heartache and stress and trauma, but I can look back and honestly say that it was a fantastic time in my life and I miss him dearly every day. There's not a day goes by I don't think about him. I still can't listen to their music. I don't think I'd ever go to a Mondays gig again.
Yeah, that'd be tough. It'd be tricky.
I was a bit resentful that they was playing so soon after he passed.
You know, Sean, on the day Paul died, Sean had lined up another bass player for the gig that night. And it was the rest of the band that were like, fuck off, no chance. Sean was willing to play the night that Paul died.
For me, Paul was the Mondays. It was like my only access to the Mondays was via Paul, and I'm not really... I've got a little bit of a friendship with Rowetta. We speak periodically. It was strange because I remember seeing him at the funeral, and I'm not going to say that I know what it's like to lose a brother, but I'm sure he was genuinely upset. But again, I've never really connected with Sean on any level. I know the stuff that Paul spoke to me about. And
so you didn't speak to him at the funeral?
No. That whole day was a bit of a blur for me, because you'd asked me to speak at the funeral, and at the last minute, I just absolutely bottled it.
It's completely understandable. I couldn't have done it. I didn't even attempt to say I would.
I remember that week before the funeral, and I was trying to write stuff out and trying to, because it's almost like there's two pools. There's the pool that was in the Mondays, and then there's the pool that I knew. Do you know what I mean? And so I honestly thought that speaking in front of Ian Brown and all those people, I just lost. I couldn't get it together to do it. And I'm kind of glad I made that decision.
You're not the only one, by the way. A lot of other people were asked and didn't feel able to do it either. So it's not just you.
What I must say is that, remember Paul, what's his name, the actor who played him in 24
Hours? Paul Popplewell.
I remember having a conversation outside with him after the funeral. We spoke for about 2 hours, actually. We was just engrossed in one another, and I really loved what he had to say at Paul's funeral. I thought it was the most poignant of speeches. And then I regretted not saying anything, but the opportunity to do this with you tonight and talk through and go through these memories is just been, it's been lovely, really.
Are there any other funny stories that we've passed over? Was there anything else that was on your list of things to?
When he was staying with me and Dawn at the mission room, the chapel, I never forget it, because him and Tom had been doing some intensive step work up at my house, and they were out in the garden doing a step four, I think. Yeah. And I always remember going up, and I put one of Dawn's dresses on. I dressed up in one of Dawn's little black dresses. And I come down and I just started cooking in the kitchen with her high heels on and this dress on. And Paul was outside. And again, it was one of those, he was laughing so much. I mean, that's the thing. He had a great, we shared a really dark sense of humour, to be honest with you. And it was, it's hard pulling these memories out of everything that went on. But there were so many times I thought, I remember being in France, like, for instance, you must have been away for the weekend, and you always used to say to me, make sure you look after him. And I used to think, why the fuck is she, like, what kind of responsibility is that to look after Paul? And we woke up one morning and Paul had gone. He disappeared. And I said to Mark and John, where the fuck is he? The Jeep's not here. That Cherokee Jeep thing you had. Where the fuck is he? So me and Mark got in the van and we're driving up the road. And I always remember going through Groncourt, the little village. And as we got out of the village, we see a couple of skid marks in the road. And then about a mile later, there was a broken indicator on the road. And then about half a mile later, there was some more glass and everything. And then we came to this bend and your Jeep was just in a field on its side. And I was like, oh, my God, he's killed himself. Yeah. So me and Mark have run over to the Jeep trying to look for him. He's not in the Jeep at all. So we get back in the van and carry on driving. We get to the next village and there's one of those funny little farmers bars where all the farmers go first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
Just sat out there with these farmers just drinking. And I was like, Paul, what the? And he's like, oh, don't worry about the car. It'll be all right. How are you going to explain this one to Ange? I was always caught in the middle between trying to please you and trying to please him. I felt it was strange. I felt like you relied on me to keep him clean and sober. I was never sure whether you knew that I was clean and sober or not when we was in France, because I was struggling. I remember one night, me and Paul had been up to that little pub in the village, and I ended up in a car with the barmaid, and she took me to wherever it was on the coast and plied me with some more drink. And then she drove me back, and I got back to the house about 4 in the morning. And you being you, working up until late, you was in the kitchen working on your computer. And I remember seeing you, and I'd ended up in the sea swimming. Yeah, right. So I was soaking wet, and I saw you in the kitchen and thought, I couldn't get into the house without getting past you. So I'm going to have to go and sleep in the on the bench. I was freezing cold because
I was told about that one. That's it. There are no more secrets.
We ended up going to Paris one night at school. But I was never aware that you knew about any of this stuff. I always thought you thought Jay was like Mr. Recovery.
No, I knew like soonish after, not at the time, but soon afterwards.
And I always felt really, really guilty about that and thought, I've got an amends somewhere along the line to make to Ange about this. And here we are talking about it now.
When did you get clean?
So I finally got clean about 2011.
Oh, wow. So a long time now.
A while after me and Dawn split up, and I was struggling, obviously, then. And then I got back into recovery. 2011. But never say never, but to go back to that place, it feels a bit inconceivable now, really.
Yeah.
Did I tell you about our celebrity funeral discussions? So we would, morbid as we were, we'd often speak about, if I die, will you come to my funeral? If you die first, will I come to your funeral? And I was like, yeah, of course I'll come to your funeral. I was like, would you come to mine? He went, nah, couldn't be asked. I was like, oh, that's great. And then we'd speak about what songs we'd have played at our funeral. And he'd said to me that without question, it would be Ceremony by New Order, which we both thought was a poignant and great choice. And then it was Starman. And he also said that he'd like Echo and the Bunnymen. And I was like, no way, because I never had pulled down for a fan of Echo and the Bunnymen. And of course, Ian got to sing the song at Paul's funeral, which the music that day, just like I said, walking into the church and Ceremony was playing. I just took me back to that day when we was on that patio thinking, I never thought this would happen. And here we are.
Yeah. Well, I remember on the day of the funeral, I remember thinking it was going to be really hard seeing Sonny and Chico carrying the coffin. And we got down and they picked the coffin up and we were walking along into the church. I thought, oh, I can do this. This is okay. Right. I can do this. And then I heard Ceremony start and I was like, oh.
Yeah. And I think that day as well, seeing the boys broke me. I remember speaking to Sonny and he was stood after the funeral. We was back at the hotel and he'd made that beautiful collage of pictures and everything.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Stood by there. And I hadn't seen Sonny since he was so high. And yeah. I said to him, oh my God, Sonny, I knew your dad. And he went, no, I know who you are. He went, and he just looked lost. And I just, heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
That's all we've got for you this week. We're going to be playing out in a moment with the track Welcome from the album Radiator by Paul Ryder's Big Arm. It's out now, so grab yourself a copy. Please give this podcast a nice review and rating and subscribe so that you don't miss out on any new episodes. Got loads more coming up. If you'd like to watch the video version of this episode, it is available on YouTube from next Sunday at 8 p.m. UK time, where I will be live in the chat. Yes, on New Year's Eve. So do join us. Please support us by joining our Patrons Club by going to patreon.com/thepaulrydertapes. Go to the website, which is paulryder.tv, and check out the shop and bag yourself some Big Arm or Paul Ryder merch. And come and join us in the chat on all of our social media pages. Big, big love to all of you. Have a really brilliant Christmas week or whenever you're listening to this. And thank you so much for being here. Big love and thanks to Jason Godwin for being such an open and candid guest. And as always, of course, big thanks and love go to the star of the show, himself, the one and the only, the late, great Paul Anthony Big Arm Ryder. Happy Christmas, everyone, especially to those of you who might be missing someone this year. Big love and see you next week.
the key word is survival in the new frontier. You're too much and I'm not good enough. 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 I'm leaving on a rocket, I've got plans to take you. Welcome to the new world, so what you gonna do?
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.